From Politico, this is Women Rule, where we bring you real talk with women bosses. I'm Anna Palmer, senior Washington correspondent and co-author of the Politico Playbook. This week, we're bringing you a podcast from a recent live taping in Los Angeles.
Thank you.
We spoke with Senator Heidi Heitkamp, the Democratic senator from North Dakota, who's facing a tough re-election battle in her state.
North Dakota supported the president by 36 percentage points. So you know, kind of, we're in a pretty red state.
Heitkamp is a Democrat in a state that voted overwhelmingly for President Trump in the 2016 election.
Senator Heitkamp.
But Heitkamp has developed something of a relationship with the current president. And last year, she was actually in the running to be Trump's agriculture secretary.
Thank you, Senator Heitkamp. Everyone's saying, what's she doing up here? But I'll tell you what, good woman, and I think we'll have your support. I hope we'll have your support.
All of that isn't so surprising. Heitkamp breaks with Democrats on a couple of key issues, including reforming gun laws.
I have a real kind of visceral reaction to the lack of appreciation or understanding about how people feel about the Second Amendment and how people feel about restrictions on the Second Amendment.
We talked about all of that and more during our live event in Los Angeles. So stay tuned for our conversation with Senator Heidi Heitkamp. On the podcast, we'll be bringing you real talk with women bosses, asking how did you make it and what advice would you give a woman looking to lead? If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe to Women Rule on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us and leave a review. And please share our episodes on social media and follow me on Twitter at @APalmerDC. You can also join the Women Rule community by texting WOMEN to 66866. Women Rule is produced by Politico in partnership with our founding partners Google and the Tory Burch Foundation. And now, our talk with my home state senator, Heidi Heitkamp.
Los Angeles. I am very excited to be here and want to welcome our listeners. We're doing this as a live podcast, our second of this year. So just to get started, we want to thank the senator for joining us today. A fun fact, I am also from North Dakota. And I recently learned that you do your own podcast for North Dakotans called
The Hot Dish.
So I don't know if this audience quite knows what hot dish is, but when I grew up, we had hot dish at least three times a week.
At least.
So which is basically a casserole. So you're basically a podcast veteran.
I am. And actually, I did talk radio back in the day. And so for about 3 months, I guest host something called News and Views, which doesn't sound like it's a big deal. But if you are familiar with Ed Schultz, that was his show. And my brother took it over, and I helped bridge because he was in the legislature and couldn't leave. And so it is the best training ever for being a politician, being a radio talk show host.
Filling time sometimes, answering questions.
No, mainly it was just like the hockey puck. Who's coming at me today?
Well, we'll have some soft hits today. But so we're in California. Two state senators are female. I want to get your thoughts on women in the Senate. This year will be a record-breaking. There will be 23 female senators in the chamber with the soon-to-be addition of Mississippi's Cindy Hyde-Smith taking over for Thad Cochran. What do you think needs to be done to get more parity? Obviously, things are getting better, but I think a lot of people in this audience and across the country would say maybe it's not getting better soon enough.
Well, more women need to run. I think that's the first thing. You can't elect women unless women run. You know, when I got into this business, basically thinking I'm not ever going to be a politician, but women need to run. And if I run, I was 28 years old when I ran my first statewide race, and I thought I could build a network of women who would help women in North Dakota, and I would contribute to the effort. This was 1984 when Geraldine Ferraro introduced the first Year of the Woman, and I ran with the first woman lieutenant governor, and we just thought, man, the sky's the limit, and by the year 2000, we're going to have parity. And then we saw this plateau, if not a downward trend, certainly in state legislatures. But I think one of the great challenges that you have is women self-select, or they don't step up because they will say, I'm not qualified. I'm not going to run for the, I need to know more. I'm not qualified. And frequently when people say that, I'm not qualified for the North Dakota legislature, I say, have you met the legislature? because, you know, trust me, you're qualified. But I think women have a tendency to not believe in their own skills. And men just have kind of, they're born with more ego, I think. And they just think, of course I'm qualified. Of course I'm, you know, going to be the next senator from California because I'm who I am. And women will always have more self-doubt.
So talk about that, though. I mean, one of the things we talk a lot to a lot of women, I've talked to some of your fellow senators who've done that, who've made that actual choice. And one of the biggest issues is raising money. And you're doing a fundraising tour right now around the country. How did you get over the hurdle? How do you personally get, you know, ask people to give you money?
It is absolutely the worst thing you do as a politician. Some people like it, and you should never trust a politician who likes raising money. Because there's something wrong with them. But it's a means to an end. And if you don't, it's like anything else. If you want to be competitive in sports, you may not like doing, you know, the early morning workouts, but you're not going to be good unless you do it. And so raising money is a lot like that. It's you have to do it. It's gotten insane. The money in politics is insane. And I think I'm a fairly competitive person, and I don't want to not do everything that I can do to actually win. And what motivates me is I think, okay, I'm going to make this one more phone call. I just hate making these phone calls and begging for money. But it means that I'll be able to be there and fight for kids. I'll be there to fight for prevent childhood trauma. I'll be there to help Native American women. I'll be there to make sure we have education opportunities. So you got to think about all the reasons why you do it. And it's not about winning this campaign. It's about what you do with the job once you have it.
So let's talk about that, because, you know, we say, yes, we want more women in office. That's a good thing. But there's been a lot of talk, and I think you've had a lot of experience where the women of the Senate band together, supporting one another, who not even just because you're Democrats, but Republican across party lines. I think one of your best friends is Senator Susan Collins of Maine. What's one time where you felt the power of women supporting women in the Senate?
I think the one time that I did was when the first shutdown that came when I was in the Senate was in 13. And, you know, of course, here you are. You're watching this and you think, oh, well, these guys have a plan. They're going to get government back up and running. And a week goes by and bad things happen. And eventually Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski started calling around, and they invited people that they thought would sit down and actually check the ego at the door and come up with a solution. And it just turned out that about half of the people who showed up were women, and most of the leaders in that effort were women, and it reopened government. And I think that was the first time I thought, they are doers. These are people who want to get something done. They're not just here to say they're a United States senator. They're here to be a United States senator. And so they've just been a lot of my role models. And those relationships that you create then lead to legislative efforts, whether it's in human trafficking, whether for Lisa and myself, we do a lot of work on Native children issues. We do a lot of work on Indigenous women's issues because she represents Alaska and I represent North Dakota. We wouldn't have that relationship, I don't think, if it weren't for the kinds of informal work that women have done in the Senate.
Sometimes you are on the opposite side of issues, obviously, with your female colleagues. I think most recently on the banking bill that you were one of the champions of.
Yep.
And you kind of were in a pretty high-profile fight with Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. Talk about what happened from your perspective, and obviously you guys disagreed, you know, pretty aggressively on this.
Yeah, that would be a characterization. That would be correct. And she's, if she were here, she'd feel just as strongly as I feel. I think that many times the differences that you experience are not gender and they're not racial, they're regional. They're where you come from. I grew up, you know where I grew up. I grew up in Manitou, North Dakota, a town of 90 people. My family was 1/10 the population, I want you to know. And
voting block.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, it helps when you have a lot of family, don't you know? Anyway, so Elizabeth has not, I think, had personal kinds of experience with relationship lending. Mm-hmm. And what I saw happening in the banking world was that that local community banker, the community bank that was supporting all of the local efforts, that was giving the guy with the shoebox with the receipts that they knew was like a great credit, they were retreating from the marketplace. And if you look at you know, what was too big to fail, which was Dodd-Frank, has become too small to succeed. Now, Elizabeth has some ideas on what you do with the big banks. We haven't talked about that. But my idea was, let's put these people back in competition with the big banks and lower their compliance costs. And the disagreement really became what you did with the regional banks. And I mean, if we can't, as women, have the ability to get into a fight like we had and then not walk away and work on another issue, then we don't belong where we are. We're going to be passionate about what we do. She believes what she believes. I believe what I believe. I happen to be right. I don't know. She would not be happy with that. Anyway, but
if you're,
you know,
listening.
But there may be 20 other issues that Elizabeth and I completely agree on.
Yeah, so for the Women Rule podcast, we often like to take a step back, kind of looking how you got here into the position that you are now, one of a gang of 100. So we talked a lot about your personal experience coming from a very small town, Kindred, where I'm from, or
Kennert.
As you would say, it is actually a town of 600, so much larger. Yeah. Clearly, a metropolis. But I wanted to ask
you—it's a suburb of Fargo.
Well, now now it is. It wasn't when I grew up. But I want to ask you, before you kind of became active in politics, you grew up in North Dakota. What did you take from that time that you talked about the importance of regionalism to how you do your job now? But were there lessons that you learned as a child, one of a big family that you kind of take with you?
I think a lot of people ask, how can North Dakota elect a Democrat senator? North Dakota supported the president by 36 percentage points, so you know, kind of we're in a pretty pretty red state. And I think that people want to know who you are. And when you think about Manador, I like to say it forged your values if you look at the institutions. And so one would be the VFW. My dad started the VFW when he got back from World War II. He brought in a lot of people. But it taught every kid who grew up there respect for that service. And so I have a hardcore belief in service, have a hardcore belief in community, whether that's at the Rural Fire Department or the Park Board or whatever it is, have a hardcore belief in how education shapes opportunity and how our religious background shapes our morality and how we approach issues. And so all those insights, I can go around Manador and kind of tell you all about, and then my first job working at the cafe as a waitress. And the place where you grew up and the family that you grew up in, I think, have a huge, long-standing consequence to who you end up being. And that's why it is so important that we have diversity, because we all bring different life experiences to this job, whether it's experience as a mother or a daughter, whether it's the experience of a farmer like John Tester, whether it's the experience of an entrepreneur who did well like Mark Warner. I mean, you can just go, or a prosecutor like Claire McCaskill. We all bring these experiences, and it is the richness of that experience that creates, I think, the best public policy.
So before you became active in politics, you were an attorney for the EPA, you were an attorney for North Dakota's tax commissioner, but it wasn't really until the 80s when you really started to become involved in politics.
Before most of you were born, yes.
What motivated you to take that step?
You know, it really was the year of the woman, and I was 27 years old, and I was going around and trying to recruit all these women who served on school boards, these women who were county commissioners, to run on the statewide ticket, and they all said no, and they said, if you think it's such a good idea, you do it. And so I thought, Kent Conrad, someone you know very well, kind of had me drafted, and I thought, well, what's the worst thing that'll happen? I'll drive around North Dakota for, you know, 3-4 months, meet North Dakotans, and win or lose, it will be an experience that will help shape who I am. And I came very close to winning against a 12-year incumbent in what was a very good Democratic year in North Dakota in 84. And then when Kent was elected to the Senate, I became the tax commissioner, which is elected. And it was, then you're on the treadmill. Then everybody says, well, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. And I was going to quit in 92. But Bonnie Polachek, who is one of my personal heroes, she began the domestic violence programs in North Dakota, came to me and she said, we need an attorney general who believes that domestic violence is a crime. And we want you to take this on. And I was passionate about that issue, ran as attorney general, and the next 8 years served as attorney general, ran in 2000 for governor. And the one thing that doesn't get talked about enough in this lane is that I think over 50% of all the women who are in the Senate ran for governor and didn't make it. And so it tells you that in many ways it's easier to run for that legislative job than the chief executive of the state. Mazie Hirono, me, yeah. Ed, Debbie, Susan Collins. I mean, go down the list. And so when that happened, I thought, I'm done. I'm not going to do that.
A failure is tough to get over. We've all had it, whether it's our own personal jobs or in certainly that's a public situation where you're running and, you know, you've been very successful so far.
Think about this. All of you out there, think about this. You're running for a job where everyone in your state gets to decide whether you get that job. The worst job interview in the history of forever, right? So you got to go out and beg to get this done. And then the rejection when you lose. You know, but I will tell you, the one thing that it did is that loss completely changed my perspective. Because I used to win elections by 68%, and I would wonder why the other 32 didn't like me. Seriously, I would just like, I would, and that's probably not a bad reaction, you know, how do you become an elected official for all the people? But when I ran for governor, I was diagnosed with stage 3A of breast cancer in September. And so this was not inconsequential to the election, as you can imagine. People would ask me, how did getting cancer change your life? And I said, not much, but losing an election sure did. and the reason why I say that is that I had to really pick myself back up and face that rejection and know that I can survive. You can take risks and survive when you fail. And you know, I'm in a very tough re-election campaign right now. And, you know, the easiest thing in the world would have said, skin that one out, the last one. They gave me an 8% chance of winning last time. And my oncologist gave me a 28% chance of living 10 years, and that was 19 years ago. So I figure I've been beating the odds a lot. So I think you have to, but how I've survived that kind of failure is I've always known why I'm doing what I'm doing. And it always is about some change that I want to see in America that I think I could give voice to or I could work with people to effectuate that change. And that's the motivation for me.
So we are going to switch gears a little bit to politics. Obviously, uh-huh. We're Politico, and we have been watching the midterms closely, and there's a lot of different political issues that are hot button right now. I want to start with one that I know you probably have a lot of maybe a different perspective than some of the people in the crowd, and that's on guns. There was a big marches across the world, obviously in Washington. Here in L.A., there was big marches after the Parkland High School shooting in Florida. You're from North Dakota. I'm from North Dakota. I grew up with hunting in my family. A lot of your constituents are big gun rights advocates. You have an A rating from the NRA. Where do you stand on some of the issues that are kind of very specific about what's going through right now?
First off, I think sometimes people have a diminished sense of the Second Amendment, and that might make everybody kind of groan who sees the tragedy that's happened in this country as it relates to gun violence. But the Second Amendment matters to me the same way. I always say, think about the restrictions you're putting on as if you were restricting search and seizure, which is also protected by the Constitution. You have to have a warrant. And I said, so you're going to take away someone's gun rights just by saying you're you know, we think you have a diagnosis of mental health challenges, so we're going to take away your gun rights without due process. And so I have a real kind of visceral reaction to the lack of appreciation or understanding about how people feel about the Second Amendment and how people feel about restrictions on the Second Amendment. I had a woman once say, you know, how she was trying to describe to a group of women how you know, what that was like where she grew up, which was Indiana. And she said, I want you to think about this. Restrictions on your right, your reproductive rights. Think about how strongly you feel about evaluating those restrictions. That's how strongly people in North Dakota and Indiana and other places feel about restricting their Second Amendment. Now, we can all have an argument about what the Second Amendment does or does not provide. My Supreme Court made some decisions on that, which I think are relevant here. But what I will say is whatever you do should work. And when we talk about background checks, for instance, and people say, well, we need these enhanced background checks. If you look at all these cases, an enhanced background check would not have changed. It would have prevented anyone from getting a gun.
So hold on. So I'm gonna control the conversation, but I appreciate the sentiment. And I will just say, is there anything? So I mean, I understand you're saying Second Amendment, you believe in it. You know, you don't want to restrict things, but is there anything? There's talk about, you know, we can go through the thing, increasing the age for somebody to purchase some of these guns, the, you know, increased background checks. Is there anything right now that you could proactively support?
Well, I mean, I with Susan Collins have the bill that came the closest to passing, which was the no fly, no buy, where we did a 14-day, mm-hmm. you can go to court. I think that we should all be looking at some kind of restraining order that where somebody is a threat to themselves or others. I was encouraged because the bill that we just passed, the funding bill, clarified that there is no restriction on CDC, actually, the Centers for Disease Control, actually studying gun violence and making recommendations. So I think there's things that we can all agree on, and then there's things that don't kind of fit state by state. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, just to appreciate and understand how people in my state, North Dakota, look at this, we probably per capita have one of the highest rates of gun ownership. And that would include a lot of guns that you guys are talking about, semi-automatics, hunting guns, rifles, shotguns. We have the lowest rate of gun crime in the country. So people look at that and they think there's a disconnect between this connection of guns with the violence that's happening in schools and communities. Probably, tragically, I was the Attorney General during Columbine and was asked by the National Association of Attorneys General to study what we could do in schools, and we issued a report on what schools should do in terms of drills and you know, hardening schools. And all of these schools have done that, but yet it hasn't prevented these kinds of shootings. And so I think we need to go back and take a look at institutions. We need to go back and take a look at where we miss the mark on so much of this. But I think if we only focus on guns, I think we will miss the opportunity to really fix this problem.
All right. We are literally getting the wrap, which is unfortunate because I have a lot of follow-up questions on that and many other things. But I do want to ask, one of the things that you talked about is this, the re-election, the midterms, and your relationship with the president, the current president. You weren't very close with President Barack Obama. What is your relationship with Trump? How do you interact with him?
Well, first off, I didn't work very closely with President Obama.
Right.
And so I think when this president came in, and it was well known that, you know, I was invited to come up and visit with him about a potential position in the cabinet, and you know, I think my attitude on all of this is that you have to understand how you can get things done no matter what the conditions are or who sits in the White House. With that said, I think we also have to be eyes wide open about the concerns that we have for where we are with institutional democracy and how we're going to work to protect democracy in this country. And we all have a role to play in that. We all have a responsibility to be very, very vigilant. It is not just thinking about tomorrow. It's thinking about how are these trends, whether it is the lack of civility in government, whether it is the lack of collaboration and cooperation, how are they affecting the long-term viability of this country? But I think we have to be honest that there is a disruption that is happening in kind of traditional democratic institutions that we need to be very guarded about. You know, if you said back my background as a lawyer and as somebody who believes in constitutional government, I think we have to be really concerned about what's happening right now, and we all have a role to play to prevent an erosion or a erosion of the democratic systems that we have.
All right, I'm going to end on a question that we ask all the women on this podcast, which is, in 2020, what woman in your party would you like to see run for president?
All of them.
No, what a combo.
I mean, I think that there are, I think that the more diverse the voices, the more new ideas that come in. I mean, what's so interesting about California to me is you've got Dianne Feinstein, who is really, I mean, she is so respected as a stateswoman. If you said define someone in America today who stands as a stateswoman, it would be Dianne Feinstein. And then you've got this young, energetic, dynamic, you know, I don't always agree with her, but boy, I respect her, Kamala Harris. And so you have this spectrum in California that really is pretty marvelous. And so, you know, either one of them wanted to run, I'd be interested in what they had to say.
All right. Well, thank you, Senator, so much. We appreciate your time tonight.
You bet.